CSI in the World. I'm John Batchelor. August 2023, CNBC reporting. Semiconductor makers wait for checks 1 year after President Biden signs the CHIPS Act. The CHIPS Act, recall that? Much ballyhooed. Going to endorse U.S. and near-shoring production called fabs for the best chips in the solar system, to my knowledge. And what's happened? Helping me understand this, Emily Delabriere and Nathan Pekarsik of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, who have a new paper up I recommend to everyone about 1 year later. Emily, I begin with the fact that the reputation of the People's Republic of China is that they've thrown a great deal of money at making high-end chips and have fallen short, that this is an art form that takes many years and not just cash being pushed in. Also, there were stories in the Wall Street Journal maybe a year, 2 years ago, maybe more, about corruption and money being diverted and a failure of building a fab at Wuhan, of all places, before the pandemic. Is that all gone? Has China corrected its structure so that it's building fabs that are competitive? Good evening to you.
Good evening, and thank you for having us on. There is certainly extensive narrative about the weaknesses in China's approach to semiconductors, which includes failures of innovation and capability at the very advanced downstream levels of the semiconductor value chain. That conversation risks missing two really important realities. The first of those is China's significant and really dominant presence at other points in the semiconductor value chain, including production of less advanced chips, but also production of inputs, including materials that are necessary for the most advanced chips. And for that reason, China's ability to control, to exact leverage over other international players and other countries in the semiconductor system. And then the other thing that's missing from this conversation is the degree to which China continues to benefit from advanced technology produced by other international players, and therefore its ability to fill the holes in its own semiconductor ecosystem. Yeah. And this is true of even the most well-known Chinese bad actors, whether that's SMIC, for example, or Huawei.
Nathan, let's get specific here. You and Emily, tell me of a company named SMIC, Chinese Semiconductor Foundry Company. It's increased its market share, including growth in the U.S. How did it do that, given the concern of the Biden administration and the awareness of the American market that China is a bad actor? What is the pitch that SMIC makes? Money, chips, availability, cost? How does it do it, Nathan?
It's a bundle of all of these things, John. As Emily outlined, China has these enduring advantages in terms of access to raw materials, so semiconductor, both legacy and compound input materials, where China has advantages, helps their players like SMIC to be able to compete globally on cost, be able to corner actual inputs so that when there are supply shocks, they're standing in a better position than some of their international partners. And I think a lot of the story with SMIC recently also is that they focused on legacy segments of the market. So not necessarily the cutting edge, but generating larger wafers that are necessary inputs across a whole host of industrial and modern electronic goods, where the rest of the global market has sort of migrated north in terms of the value add products that they generate. SMIC is able to increase its market share by dominating the legacy segments that may come with lower profit margins, but according to the Chinese logic, offer an opportunity to gain market share that then affords both commercial and security returns for the company itself, as well as for the broader Chinese ecosystem. So having this large keystone player that the rest of the world depends on tends to be something that the Chinese government and the board of SMIC think fondly of.
But Emily, I read here, you're reporting with Nathan, that SMIC, SMIC, opened an office in Irvine, California. It's on the Commerce Department's entity list. How do those things go together, Emily?
I think that this is like the loopholes in U.S. regulations and also the rhetoric reality gap. We have this conception, especially in narrative and headlines, in the U.S. that because a company is on the entity list, it's fully barred from the U.S. system. Nothing can get to it. It can't operate in the U.S. But that's not how things work. First of all, the entity list listing is not that extensive. And second of all, there are a host of exceptions, waivers that can be pursued for entity listed players. This is still, even if you're just operating at the level of SMIC being SMIC, there's a whole other issue, and this is getting beyond your question, forgive me, but it's important. There's a whole other issue of the ease with which companies like SMIC can set up subsidiaries or partner players and use them to do exactly what they were doing and what they're supposed to be blocked from doing as a result of being on the entity list.
So we're watching this. You're watching this. I'm presuming other players are watching this and saying, hey, they're getting away with it, so we're going to be part of this as well. Is that what happens in the U.S.? They figure there's no cost to crossing into the entity list commercialization.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that this is where the allure of the Chinese market also comes into play when you consider that these competitive pressures push on even the American companies to want to continue to do business, even with players that are problematic and have been documented by the U.S. government as problematic and carry certain legal and regulatory risks. But the reality is that the Chinese market's an important place. It's what gives these Chinese companies their strength. It's also what attracts and keeps American companies engaged and to some extent cooperating with various obvious enemies. So the American champions, the Qualcomms or Intels of the world, continue to operate in the Chinese market because they have certain cost reductions that they achieve from partnering with companies like these on the ground in China who have lower operating costs. They also assume and hope that they're someday going to increase their own market share and revenues being derived from a growing Chinese market. That's yet to be seen. And frankly, I think the Chinese government and these Chinese champion firms have their own designs on the Chinese market and their own tools for guaranteeing that American companies don't redeem any of the riches there. But it's an active part of the competitive pressures that force even the American private sector to push back against and to some extent overlook the obvious security risks that are apparent in dealing with these Chinese companies.
Again, Emily, you're reporting CXMT, China's dram shop, is buying from NVIDIA. NVIDIA, that's the highest end in the solar system. NVIDIA certainly knows who its client is, certainly knows its clients are funded by the mainland. Doesn't it bother anybody?
They're making money off of the sales, and they need inputs from the Chinese market. And or production from the Chinese market and or sales into the Chinese market. And all of those things right now, unfortunately, seem to be influencing corporate decisions and corporate decisions on the part of America's technological champions more than does any patriotic desire or B, more realistically, fear of the U.S. regulatory system. And it's the disincentives it's putting out there to deal with Chinese players.
There have been announcements from the Biden administration over the last year. I don't follow them. You do. Have any of those announcements said, hey, cut this out, NVIDIA? NVIDIA is extremely highly priced because of AI. It would seem vulnerable if the White House spoke, is it?
Absolutely. I think it's rhetorically and to the letter of the law, the point of export restriction actions that were taken in October of 2022, and then even more recently, also squarely within the mandate of investment screening executive orders that were issued just over the past month. But the reality is that the devil's in the details of enforcement on all of these things, the proclamations, the executive orders, even the legislation and the action of executive agencies like the Commerce Department's BIS, which oversees export restrictions. All of these moves, they can garner, aggressive and hyperbolic headlines across U.S. media. But it all boils down to how are these measures implemented and enforced? And the reality is that the growth of NVIDIA or any player's financial performance as tied to the Chinese market tells us that these things aren't being enforced or implemented to their fullest extent or to the letter, let alone the spirit of the strategic intent that underlies the moves. So I think that by and large, you know, these companies aren't being impacted. They're able to either through direct lobbying or through the formal waiver processes that exist, able to continue to sell. And I think the other bad guys that obviously need to be made sort of a part of this conversation is that on the Chinese side, they also get a vote. They apply their own competitive pressures, and they also use untoward and indirect means to guarantee that they're accessing technology. So if you're an American company, if you're an NVIDIA or some other, you know that you face certain intellectual property risks and competitive risks from the Chinese market. And those, you know, also place pressure on you to want to gain any revenue that you can now before your Chinese competitors are able to steal your intellectual property and outcompete you over the long term. And I think sometimes those, you know, business decisions and then the way that Chinese players compete and behave in the marketplace lead to really poor outcomes for certainly for American security. And then I think even over the intermediate and long term for the American corporate interests as well. But I think it's a maelstrom of all these factors floating around. And the end of it is the structural balance here is that China has some real trump cards in the semiconductor game. Our policies and tools need to be updated to recognize how China's competing. Even our most aggressive actions, the things that we've announced in terms of export restrictions last October, the more recent investment screening, so outbound and outbound CFIUS process, all of those things have yet to have a real material impact on the Chinese players.
I'm speaking to Nathan Pekarsik and Emily Delibriere of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies 1 year after the CHIPS Act and how the Chinese are managing to accelerate their participation in the worldwide chip demand. When we come back, what is to be done? I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.